and then we'll go forward, okay? Always catching people up a little bit. So we've been talking the last couple of weeks about social justice, and just to backtrack and go over by name, what we kind of covered last week, and then go forward, all right? When we talk about justice generally, particularly in the context of Christian social justice, and we're going to start with the Christian perspective, and then move on to, as we talk about specific instances, where Judaism and Islam differ a little bit, but also where Hinduism and Buddhism might, and some of the more Eastern religions might differentiate. We'll talk about that as we're talking about specific instances and doing a little bit of work with that. But as we talk about justice generally, there are four senses in which we explore social justice. All right? The first is, and I used all the formal words from theology last time, but I'll make it a little simpler this time.
Do both.
Okay. The first one is a norm, the theological words is a norm for human moral agency that has its source in the being and agency of God.
Repeat that.
Yes. A norm for human moral agency that has its source in the being and agency of God.
A norm for human, what was the next word?
Moral.
Okay, thank you.
Agency. Now, what that means translated is a standard for our action as moral individuals. So the standard by which we judge our moral actions that is based on the fact that God exists and that God acts in a moral way. All right? So we don't just have a standard for human moral action. Any group can set a standard for human moral action. Our standard for judging human moral action is based on the fact that A, God exists, and that B, God acts in a moral way. All right? So that's the first sense in which, as we talk about social justice and acting in the world, that's the first place we go. The second is the virtue of the moral agency. So when we act morally, what are the virtues in which we're acting? And this is more complicated than it sounds.
Very complicated.
Because we think we're doing good, and maybe we're not. And the example of this that is less politically fraught than some of them is, if you've read any English literature, you're familiar with the concept of Lady Bountiful. You know, the lady of the manor who would go and visit her poor, right? And if they were deserving poor, she might bring them soup or, you know. Well, A, that puts her in the position of being the kind of judge of people. But also, often what she brought them wasn't what they needed. You know, bringing people your daughter's cast-off ball dresses, whose children
don't have shoes.
Yes, is maybe not as virtuous as you think it is. Okay, and it's the kind of more personal thing is every time there's a natural disaster, people say to me, "Well, when are we going to collect and send things?" Uh-huh. And I always say, "Well, we're not," because in places where there's been a natural disaster, the last thing they need is people to send stuff, because then they have to find a place to store the stuff when often there isn't a place to store stuff. They need to pay people to sort the stuff. They have stuff then that they can't use. If you really want to be helpful, the way to be helpful is to send money that they can spend on what they need when they need it and that they don't have to store.
Right. But another example would be if someone does something for the wrong reason.
Yes.
I mean, they do something good, but it's only to make themselves look good.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Pride. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Pride. That is. Mm-hmm. Yes. That is okay. A perfect. Perfect example. So that's the second one: the virtue of the moral agency. All right. Our action. What is the virtue of our actions? The third, and this is another one: a norm for governing human relationships that compares and contrasts with the standard of love of neighbor. Yes. A norm for governing human relationships that compares and contrasts with the standard of love of neighbor. Okay, so our standard as Christians is God's command to love our neighbors as ourselves. So what is our norm for governing our relationships with each other, and how does it conform to or not to that standard of love your neighbor as yourself? Note it doesn't just say love your neighbor. It's love your neighbor as yourself. So it's not just treating others what you think is well, but treating others the way you would want to be treated yourself, which is a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's the third one. The fourth one. I love these words. The normative ordering. So the normative ordering and distribution of social benefits and burdens among members of a commonwealth. So our society is supposedly governed for the common good. In that context, how do we distribute the goods of society and also the burdens of society? And that's everything from tax policy to who serves in the military to how do we distribute public education? How do we distribute funds for roads and transportation? How do we distribute the goods of our society, and how do we distribute the burdens of our society?
Education. Mm-hmm. I mean, education mm-hmm. is an example of how it mm-hmm. works or doesn't work.
Or doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So how do we do all those things? So those are the four senses. As we talk about specific instances, we're going to refer back to, all right, so looking at issues of immigration or tax policy or education, or let's look at these four senses. How do we do it now? What might a more just way to do it be? And how does our faith inform that? All right. Now, two other things. As Christians, we need to remember that our God, and this is also true for all the other Abrahamic religions, Judaism and Islam, our God shows a particular concern for the powerless. And that's from the beginning of Scripture. If you read the Bible from beginning to end, God is consistently concerned with people who have no power. And as I mentioned last week, if you read the Old Testament, you hear the phrase over and over and over again of the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner in your land, right? Because those were the people in particularly the first part of the Old Testament, and as the nation of Israel is establishing itself as a nation and not just wandering tribes, who were the most powerless. The widow, the orphan, and the sojourner were the most powerless. And the laws of God consistently call on the people to care for the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner in your land, not to oppress the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner in your land. And then when you move on to the prophets are often coming to the kings and the people and saying, you're oppressing the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner in your land, and if you don't stop, God is going to get you. And, you know, God's really ticked at you, and, you know, that you know the cycle of the prophets, right? The prophet comes and says, stop. And the people say, I'll stop for a while. And then they don't really stop. And so then the next prophet comes and says, God says, no, and they don't. So that's one piece. And then the commandments that to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God come back to that too. That same sense that the way it gets phrased in theology is that God has a preferential option for the poor. But it's a little broader than that. It's really that God has a preferential option for the powerless. And the poor are a subset of the powerless. But there are other groups that are powerless. Now, if you look at our world, the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner in your land still applies. But there are other groups, right, that we might include in that group of the powerless. Think about people who are mentally ill are powerless in our society. So there's other groups beyond widow, orphan, and sojourner now that are included in that group of powerless. Two other things. There are a couple of challenges to the concept of justice, right? And we talked about this last time. The first challenge is scarcity. The fact that we don't have enough to do everything that we might want to do. But particularly the challenge to justice, when there is actually true, serious scarcity, communities of people tend to govern themselves in just ways. When there actually is a drought or a famine or a hurricane or genuine scarcity, people's best natures tend to come out and they govern themselves in just ways,
in fairness.
So
you see that things like the campfire,
yes,
how the whole country,
right,
pours out,
right,
you know.
Or as people are fleeing from a hurricane, mm-hmm, you know, they, the government and all the people come down on people who are price gouging, right? Mm-hmm. It's the moderate scarcity, the sense that we don't really have enough, and that if you have a little more, I might have a little less. That really is the challenge to justice.
Yeah.
When it's not that we don't have enough for everybody to be sustained, it's when we don't have enough for everybody to be comfortable. That is the real challenge to justice. And so how do we distribute comfort as opposed to sustenance?
Example of that, what Sue, I think, mm-hmm, referred to is our tax dollars for, mm-hmm, education,
yes,
in the,
mm-hmm,
public schools.
Yes. And then the second challenge to justice is diversity. All right? Both racial and ethnic and cultural diversity, but also moral diversity, where people come at morality and justice from different perspectives. That's a challenge to particularly Christian concepts of social justice, because if we truly are going to love our neighbor as ourselves, then we want our positions to be respected. We have to respect where others are. And the more homogeneous, the more the same a society is, the easier it is to decide what justice is. But the more different perspectives you have, the harder it is to determine.
There's a comfort in sameness.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine differences in morality, though. That's, mm-hmm, that, you don't have examples of that.
I do, actually.
Oh, do you?
and this is a really good example. In Hinduism, okay, let me back up and go from our place and then to their place. In our moral framework as Christians, assisting the poor is nearly always going to be virtuous. Even if we're doing it from maybe not so great motives, helping the poor is generally considered a universal good. Right? That's because our moral structure is God has a preferential option for the poor, and God calls on us to care for the poor and the powerless. And we will be judged by how we follow that, right? The Hindu moral universe says that this life is one in a progression in which you are working your way towards perfection. And that suffering in this particular life may be a lesson that you need to learn to help you move towards perfection. And so helping the poor may get in the way of their journey towards perfection. And so it is not actually a good, it's an evil. Because you are preventing them from reaching nirvana. All right? So when we talk about moral diversity, that's only one example.
Right.
But if you read Mother Teresa's writings when she first started working in India, this is one of the things that she hit against, was that people would try to prevent her from helping the poor because they thought she was doing something really bad. You know, don't do that.
Right.
You know, then that person will have to be born again poor to learn the lesson they were supposed to learn. If you don't do that, then when they're born again, next time they won't have to do this suffering.
So that's the caste system.
Some of it. No, I mean, the caste system is born into.
Mm-hmm. So it's like the luck of the draw, whether you are born poor
and
or
in Western moral thought, we talk about the veil of ignorance. That you don't know if that if you want to build a just society, pretend that you don't know the circumstances of your birth, and then design a system that would be fair. So if you don't know that you would be born in a middle-class family, what would a fair system look like for everybody if you don't know how you're going to be born? The Hindu moral universe says that there is no such thing as a veil of ignorance, that everybody is born poor, everybody is born with resources, everybody is born with more resources, and that the challenge is to learn the lesson of that your circumstances are meant to teach you. And not to interfere with the lessons anybody else is supposed to be learning.
It seems like it would foster a superiority kind of.
You know, it can.
I learned my lesson, I'm up here.
It can. But the other piece is that a lot of Hindu theologians actually say that people who are poor are farther along the journey to farther along the journey to nirvana. That the lessons they're learning are the more complicated and difficult ones, and that the rich people are learning lesson A, and that the poor people are on lesson D.
So don't the rich assume they were?
They do, but theologians don't. Yeah. And this is true, you know, in any religion. You know, the theologians teach one thing and the way people live it is, you know, is something different. You know. But if you're in a culture of moral diversity, then what is justice when you have people in your commonwealth who see the world differently than you do? If there is no compromise between them, if they're not compatible, how do you build a just society that takes both views into account if you can't?
So where does tolerance fit in this?
Well, tolerance, when we talk about diversity, tolerance is step one. Tolerance is, I'll accept that you're different and you're wrong, but I'll tolerate you being wrong in my presence.
But if you say you're wrong, then you're judging, right?
You are.
Yeah.
But tolerating is allowing people to exist without attempting to change their mind. That's kind of level one. But then you move on to acceptance, which is, you know, you might be right. And then inclusion, which is, okay, you can be a part of the group even though we don't agree. And then equality, which is your view has the same weight as mine. So tolerance is the first level of leading to equality. Equality is the goal, which is your views and mine are equal. How do we live together? And if you want a real life look at that, look at the position of the LGBTQ community in our society.
That's what I was just thinking.
In the last 50 years.
But let's go all the way back to to Moses. At that time, when he came down from the mountaintop, wasn't he, in a way, declaring superiority of the people, of the Hebrew people?
Oh, sure. And God, from the beginning, God declares the superiority of the Hebrew people. You are my chosen people.
Right, so there's no equality there.
No. But if you, what's very interesting is if you look at what the rules of God for his people through time, and look at them in the context of their own time, they are always radically just and merciful and inclusive for the context of their time.
But by being that, they see themselves as superior to those that are not living that way.
They see themselves as superior to the surrounding nations.
Right.
But the laws for within their own nation, if you, for example, if let's go to when the Israelites first established their nation in the Promised Land, right? If you are a foreigner living with them, they are to treat you exactly as they treat each other.
And do you think in reality they saw that person as...
Of course not. That's why God kept sending prophets.
Right.
But that was...
That was the standard
God held them to, which for that time was ridiculous. Nobody else accepted foreigners as one of their own.
Yeah.
You got rid of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're dangerous, and they're going
to... You built a wall.
You built a wall. Literally. Out of stone.
But they weren't the foreigners. They were the slaves. So it was almost as like the Lord was elevating them to a place where everybody else was.
That's right. And this is what God says. This is the reasoning God gives, is you will not oppress the foreigner who lives among you. Remember that you were a foreigner in Egypt.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So remember that you didn't like it when it was done to you.
And then the Romans come.
Uh-huh. And then the Romans. And Babylonians before that.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, The teachings of God are always for their time, radically just and inclusive and merciful. So another example of this is we see God moving the people from, if somebody takes out your eye, you wipe out their entire family and take their slaves and their property as your own, to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which for its time was ridiculous. It was ridiculously weak. That's a weak law. Don't you believe in law and order, they would have said if they had Fox News or, you know, CNN at the time. You know, nobody else lived by that standard. If you injure me, I destroy you. That was what everybody understood the way of the world was. And God said, no, I say to you, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So when Jesus comes, he says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And I say to you, if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other as well. But this has not much to do with social justice, but but it's something I really like. In Jesus' time, you hit an equal with the back of your hand. I'm sorry, you hit an equal with the front of your hand. You hit a subordinate with the back of your hand. So when he says, if someone strikes you on the left cheek, I say to them, turn to them to right as well. I'm not actually going to hit you.
Oh, I see.
But if I hit you with the back of my hand, now you turn the other, turn your cheek, so I have to hit the other cheek. What do I have to do?
Mm-hmm.
I have to make you an equal.
I see.
Oh wow!
Oh, okay. Well, I never heard
so,
that
so it's not about it's not actually about being a doormat. Mm-hmm. It's about you can maintain your dignity
by elevating them.
By elevating without fighting back.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
You know, if you hit me back, and I'm the Roman soldier, I'll just take you out. Mm-hmm. But if you turn the other cheek and I want to keep hitting you, I now have to do it as an equal. The next thing he says is, if someone makes you walk with them a mile, walk with them another. Mm-hmm. Well, the law was very strict. As a Roman soldier, part of the reason they had mile markers was so you knew how long a mile was. As a Roman soldier, I could command you to carry my luggage for a mile. Mm-hmm. But if I made you carry it for more than a mile, I was liable for judgment by my superior, because that was against the law. So if you keep going after the mile marker, you've changed my position from the oppressor who's making you do something to the supplicant who's chasing after you, begging you to put the burden down so I don't get in trouble.
Wow. It's interesting when you put it in the context of the
time. Yes. It changes everything.
Yeah. That's what Jesus is teaching is there are ways to require your own dignity, to stand up for your own dignity, that don't require violence.
Well, it sort of fits with when you said, do unto me like I would be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I would like to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So,
equalizing.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, that brings us to looking at different perspectives of Christian social justice. So I gave you some kind of senses and some foundational things to start with. You will be stunned, I know, to learn that not all Christians interpret scripture and church tradition in the same way and come to the same conclusions. I realize that is radically new news for you, but there actually are, you can actually get your hands around it a little bit. In the what we call Christian moral theology, there are basically five schools of Christian moral theology. All right? When you first start reading it, you think, oh my God, there's 1,000 of these. But it really boils down to about five. And where these all come from is the challenge of morality and ethics is not actually the challenge between good and evil. The challenge between good and evil is basically a relatively simple moral choice. We can identify evil when we see it, mostly.
I know it when I see it.
We know it when we see it. We're not bad, I think, about something.
So.
Yeah, pornography, maybe. But making a decision between good and evil is not the difficult moral choice. The difficult moral choice is when two goods are in conflict. Right? Choosing between good and bad is not hard. When you can only do one of two things and both of them are good, that's when we get to difficult moral choices. Where am I on time? Okay. So that's when we get to difficult moral choices, is when goods are in conflict. And so there are basically five schools that you bring to when you talk about Christian moral theology. Some of them use terms that we use in the political world, but they mean different things in when you're talking about moral theology. Because why would we use different words? That would make it easy. Especially the first two, I'm going to use some terms that have meaning in our secular political world. They take on slightly different meanings in Christian moral theology. All right, I'm just warning you now. because, you know, that's only fair.
So if you're not confused, we will get confused.
So if you're not confused yet, you will be. All right, so five things. First one, the first kind of perspective on social justice is libertarianism.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a similar understanding as libertarians in the political world, that the foundational principle is the autonomy of the individual. And so that states and communities should interfere as little as possible with the autonomy of the individual. So, yes, as few laws as possible, as et cetera, et cetera. Libertarianism is more concerned about the strategies employed than the outcome. So, it says, remember, the greatest good is the individual autonomy. So, even if we can accomplish a greater good through group effort, if we compel the group effort, that's bad. It doesn't matter how good the outcome is. If it's achieved by compelling the participation of the individual, then it's bad. So we go back to the virtue of the moral action. Providing food for the poor is a moral good. If it's done by taxation, it's bad because taxation is violence. All right. Anything that compels the individual is violence. So violence isn't just violence as we think about it. Violence is anything that you are compelled to do against your will. And if you think about it, the threat of our tax system is ultimately, if you don't pay your taxes, you're going to go to jail. That's violence.
But what about comment of Jesus, pay unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but unto God
that which is God's?
Yeah.
They kind of ignore that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because that seems like it says pay your taxes.
It does seem like it's saying. This is libertarianism that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Libertarianism says that liberty is the chief. Okay, libertarianism, liberty.
Liberty of the individual.
Liberty of the individual conscience is the chief. So they would say, it's not bad to feed the poor. And if your conscience says you should feed the poor, then you should absolutely feed the poor.
So basically no boundaries?
Pretty much. You should not compel others to follow your conscience.
In other words, if I'm being good, it's because myself is telling me to be good.
That's right.
And I'm permitted. Isn't that kind of denying a God in some
way? No, what they're saying is, your moral agency is normed to the being and agency of God as you understand it.
And it's an internal thing.
And it's an internal thing. So your individual faith compels your moral actions. And your individual faith compels your actions, and your individual faith compels your actions. And all of that is fine to the point that, but the boundary is, you can't compel anybody else to act according to your conscience.
But that works if everybody has that same compulsion to do good.
That's right.
Right. Without him.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it is less concerned that the good is done less effectively or efficiently than it might be if
we did it together.
If and if you want to do it together, you can choose to do it together, but you can't compel anybody else to participate. All right. So the premise is, now obviously this is, none of these systems do you actually work 100% in practice, right?
Right.
But if you have to make a choice
in a community, what did you use
in a commonwealth?
Commonwealth. Thank you. That wouldn't work.
Right. But if you're a libertarian, what you say is we impose the minimal amount on the individual conscience that is necessary to maintain the commonwealth. So to put it in a real context, should the government pave roads? Well, what is the minimum amount we can get away with and still maintain connection in society? And then if you want the roads in your, you know, in your subdivision paved, you talk to your neighbors and convince them that you should do it, but the government shouldn't make you do it. All right?
Or shouldn't make you pay taxes.
Shouldn't make you pay taxes. Yes, you're because taxation is violence.
But if you think that's a good idea, you can pay them, right?
Yeah, if you want to pave the roads, and if you want to pay...
But there will be no
then you do it yourself.
That's right.
Okay.
But in a perfect world, there wouldn't even be a government.
That's right.
A libertarian world.
Yes. Yes.
Is that Bernie?
Well, Bernie,
No, Grandpa.
And both, actually.
Really?
They both, they
I'm
get...
I'm sorry, I just couldn't
yes. But actually, both of them are libertarian.
Interesting.
And also the thing about the libertarians is not only about the distribution of the goods and the burdens of society, but about individual morality.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So very few laws, as few as possible, mm-hmm. that restrict individual behavior because your conscience and your God will tell you what's right.
Wow.
And no one has the right to interfere with...
It's hard not to think of it just in the political
yes.
sphere. Like,
oh,
we wouldn't have any mm-hmm. one-way road. We wouldn't
yes.
have any...
Right,
no,
exactly.
You
right.
I mean, you know,
exactly. That's exactly yeah. right.
That would be hard. And, so hard for the common. Holy cow.
And one of the guiding principles of libertarianism, they have a very high, and I'm about to use a term that is, you know, you're learning all the words. They have a very high, what's called theological anthropology. They have a very, they think human beings are predominantly moral.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
So
and so the basis...
They think very highly of themselves.
Well, and of all of us, of humanity.
Beings.
Yes.
Okay.
That they believe that human beings are by default...
Wow.
Good.
Okay.
And so that our default is to do the right thing. And that we need to have a minimum number of laws for those people who are disordered, they would say, who do the wrong thing or confused. Right, so we need to have the minimum amount mm-hmm. of laws that interfere with our basic compulsion to be good.
Hmm. How does that compare with Quakers?
Quakers are libertarian
within
yeah. themselves.
Okay.
That's why they don't have leaders.
Yeah, right.
Mm.
Right.
Okay. I was going to say, how do they look upon like the Ten Commandments?
Well, the libertarians would say that those are. That is God giving the minimum restrictions mm-hmm. on behavior. And do we need much more than that?
Oh.
Don't love God, love your neighbor, honor your parents.
Don't kill.
Don't kill, don't steal, don't want what other people have, don't tell lies.
Right, there you go.
So when Christ said, love God.
Mm-hmm.
And love others, and that's it.
On these two
he
commandments.
Was totally libertarian.
On these two commandments hang all.
That's true.
Jesus says, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets.
Okay.
Love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. Okay. Love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets.
I think I'll run for office on that. This was a libertarian. He tried.
In spirit.
Christian libertarian says that. They say, why do you need any more rules than what Jesus gave you? Love God, love neighbor.
Oh, if it were only that easy, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're thinking in this vein, mm-hmm. why would it be difficult for Christian morality mm-hmm. to live side by side equally mm-hmm. with Hindu morality?
It wouldn't. If you do a full libertarian view.
If you were true to the spirit.
Right. You do what you believe is right.
Mm-hmm.
You allow them to do what they believe is right. Mm-hmm. And you don't impose.
It would be the easiest way to get
the anomaly of the guy who comes in and is, you know, with his hatchet and starts killing people.
Yeah, where does evil fit in?
Well, what the libertarian view would say is that evil is disordered. It is a human being who is in some way damaged. And so, obviously, you stop people from damaging others. But you don't... The libertarian view, and a really good example of this is Benjamin Franklin. When he built the corrections system in Pennsylvania, when they established that, and Franklin did it, so, you know, this is not one of those that Thomas Jefferson created macaroni and cheese stories. Ben Franklin actually did this. It was the first time that a prison was called a correctional institution. And the premise was people who commit crimes are damaged or ill. And so they need to be corrected and returned to society rather than punished. Right? And that comes right out of Christian libertarianism that says the human default is to be good. If you're not being good, then something's wrong, and we need to restore you to the human default, which is to be good. Okay. So the concept of a person who chooses to be evil without being damaged doesn't exist in the libertarian worldview. Okay. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. All right. Now, obviously, you can see, and you have seen, and we've talked about the flaws of this. Any of these, when you push them to the extreme, you're like, okay, wait, but what about?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. But the other thing I want you to keep in mind about libertarianism is that they actually believe that any societal compulsion is violence. So requiring people to pay taxes is violence. Requiring people to follow laws against their conscience is violence. All right? And they don't make a distinction between that kind of violence, violence to the conscience, and violence to the body.
So, like, back in the Vietnam era, mm-hmm. when young men and some families were fleeing mm-hmm. rather than serve in a war that they didn't believe in, mm-hmm. they were mm-hmm. illegal. Mm-hmm. They were prosecuted if found, mm-hmm. but that, from a libertarian point of view, they should not have been.
From a libertarian point of view, that was terribly evil.
Yes.
Well, the libertarians would say
I'm feeling like a libertarian. Yeah.
Well, libertarians would say forcing anyone to serve in the military. Is
mm-hmm. well, that's what I'm thinking.
Let alone fight, forcing anyone to serve in the military, again against their will. Now, if you choose to do that, that's up to you. But
I also thought that us getting into the Vietnam War.
Libertarians have a very limited, again, depending on where you are, like anything, there's a spectrum. But true libertarianism says there's a very small set of things in which force is acceptable. And basically, it's to prevent violence to another is the only... Is the only acceptable use of violence is to prevent violence to another. And then they get caught in the trap.
That's one of those things. In theory, it's wonderful, but in the practical world.
In the practical world, the limits...
You see the failings. Yeah.
The limits need to be somewhere else.
Humanity is a little more complex.
Right. And you'll see that with all of these things. None of these things, if you take it to their extreme and only use that, would actually create a functional society. Mm-hmm. We talked about last week... If you read the book of Acts, the first Christians, for about 20 years, tried having everything in common, right? Okay. The idea that that we are a community, we have everything in common, we share completely. And it worked for about 20 years and then fell apart and started falling apart pretty early. Because we don't humans don't actually work that way.
Right? Back in the 50s, I suggested that in a religion class in a Catholic school.
Oh,
and had detention for a week.
Suggested what? That everybody...
That the first Christians were communists.
They were.
Oh, I got you.
And it was in the 50s.
A little deep thing you found back then. Oh, you're on a list someplace.
Yeah.
Your name is on a list.
Yeah, we'll do a FOIA request to see what the FBI has about you. But... You know, it's true. You know, if you read the book of Acts, the first Christians,
it says,
had everything in common and they lived together. Mm-hmm. But it didn't last very long because actually having everything in common is pretty difficult to
sustain. Yeah, we all want something that's ours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we're willing to fight for it.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to see a kind of modern, much less importantly moral example of that, there's some companies now that are doing what they call hot desking, where you don't have your own assigned desk. You just come in and pick a place and work wherever you are. And they're finding it really difficult because people like to, you know.
Yeah, this is like my space.
Yeah. And it's like coming to church on Sunday and just...
And somebody's sitting in your pew.
In the same place.
And everyone's going to take your locker. They say, my locker. We don't.
So that sense of, you know, while it's all common, it doesn't matter who uses what.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the work environment, it's mm-hmm. it's an issue of more practical things, mm-hmm. like there are certain papers and documents and things you've created, reports you've written, mm-hmm. designs you've created that you have to protect and have easy access to them.
Yes, and the companies that do this store all that stuff in the cloud.
Oh, so you can access them from any... Today, that's a little bit easier
anyway.
With computers. But
ask a teacher who has to travel.
Yes, I used to have.
I have to say, though, as a part-time teacher, that often happened to me.
Yep.
Yes.
I went in the teacher's room, and whatever desk was free is the one I got to use.
Yep.
Because I wasn't there all the time.
But did you feel lesser? Like
yes,
definitely. You do.
For many other reasons as well.
Yes.
That was one of them.
In one of the buildings, my desk was under the staircase.
Oh, no. Okay, and this is a really good example. When we talk about distributing the goods of a particular society, right, the goods of that particular teaching system is the space to work.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so who gets the good spaces to work and who has to work?
Who gets the windows?
Who gets windows? Inside?
Who gets
the corner
to, and who has to work under the stairs? And on what basis do you make that decision?
Usually seniority.
Mm-hmm. And is that the most just way?
Probably. You served your time.
A little different than a charter school.
Yeah.
Seniority doesn't.
So, but you see the you see the practical,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
All right. So that's libertarianism. I think. What time is it? All right.
Just read the other ones if you don't.
I will read the other one. I'll give you the names of the other ones, and then we'll explore them in more detail.
I'm just curious.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The others are liberalism, which again doesn't have much to do with the Democratic Party.
Liberalism.
Yeah. Liberation theology, which you might have heard of. Feminism, which again is connected to but not the same as secular feminism, and virtue ethics.
So these are the five that encompass all the religions?
That encompass all of Christian thinking.
Oh, Christian, okay.
All of Christian thinking. And the within each of them there's 1A, 1A, 1B, but mm-hmm. basically libertarianism, liberalism, liberation theology, feminism, and virtue ethics, all Christian approaches to social justice and moral theology fit into one of those.
Okay. I'm guessing the Catholic Church is not in feminism.
No.
Or liberalism.
No, the Catholic Church hierarchy fits into liberalism, which you will find surprising. Somewhat into virtue ethics, but really into liberalism. The Catholic social justice movement fits into liberation theology more than any of the others. The Episcopal Church also fits into liberalism, although we have a bunch of people who fit into the feminism school, and the kind of, and some in the liberation theology, but the, and the tug of war between that.
I was just going to say, if the tension in the church, I'm Catholic, yeah. So I'm coming from there, but the tension in the church now isn't coming from that. There's
no.
Maybe the congregation and the hierarchy in
yes,
different places.
In two different places.
Already,
yeah. And, yeah. And in the Episcopal That's Church, true. In our history, in the 70s, 60s and 70s, you found a tension between the feminist school and the liberalism school, and now you're finding tension between the virtue ethics people and the liberalism people in the Episcopal Church.
So if you can fit into multiple brackets, how do you find peace?
Oh.
I mean you individually or the churches themselves?
Either way. I mean, individually, you're fighting yourself because you're fighting all these different categories, and where should you be? And then as the whole group, like, say, the whole Catholic Church or the whole Episcopal Church, if you logistically fit more than one category, what are you?
Well, that's an interesting point. Individually, and kind of individually is what we're talking about here, individually, you make the decision on a specific case-by-case basis. And for most of us, there is one of these that we mostly feel comfortable with and will make most of our moral and ethical decisions out of. Until that one doesn't work for a particular case that we find ourselves against, and then we'll adapt one of the others to fit. And that's what most people, how most people make their ethical decisions. We don't think about it that way, but we have a particular
bends
or, you know, value system of our own, and we act out of that until it doesn't work. And then we figure out how to make the compromises necessary to make a decision.
You're saying that all of these are consistent with the Bible and
yes.
the Word of God.
Yes.
It's just a matter of
yes.
a little different interpretation of...
Mm-hmm. All of them are consistent with the Bible and the Word of God. It depends on, and what they depend on is, which of the values that God teaches us do you see as primary? Is really what it comes down to. And where on the spectrum of the goods that are in tension do you fall? The one I talk about all the time is God of mercy, God of justice, right? God is mercy, God is just. While a merciful God forgives all transgressions, so if you're way at the end of the mercy spectrum, there is never any accountability, there's only forgiveness. If you're way at the end of the just God spectrum, which is also a virtue of God, then there is only accountability, and mercy only comes after
you've reconciled.
So those are two ends of a spectrum. Most people don't sit at either end. We sit somewhere in the middle. But which one do you lean towards?
What in the Bible would give you any indication that those would be in conflict? Because it would seem to me that it depends on the heart of the person who is transgressed.
Talking about what in the Bible says that those two things are in conflict is much longer than I have,
okay.
more time than I have. But
I can't see a situation where God would favor justice over mercy if the person in their heart was truly...
Well, if you look at the Old Testament, God almost always favors justice.
But that's irrelevant.
No.
In this world, the coming of Christ?
No.
The Old Testament?
No, because Jesus says himself that he has not come to abolish the law.
Right.
So what God teaches us in the Old Testament laws are still lessons that Jesus says we need to learn. So, you know, and if you look at those Old Testament laws, there are lots of places where it doesn't matter if you confess and are repentant, you still have to pay a price for the crime that you committed. And yet, there are times when God's mercy completely forgives.
So you're saying forgives. that God can forgive, mm-hmm. but may still extract...
May still extract a penalty. And so that's so that's justice mm-hmm. balanced with mercy. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, for us, where's the pivot point mm-hmm. where justice and mercy balance? Mm-hmm. And for each individual, mm-hmm. where that pivot point is...
Getting back mm-hmm. to the individual...
Yes.
And this, you mm-hmm. know, someplace in between, mm-hmm. maybe by decades, mm-hmm. I find myself... going to mm-hmm. one, you know, it's like a pendulum. Mm-hmm. By decades of my, I guess, maturity mm-hmm. or circumstance, go mm-hmm. from one side to the other.
Well, perhaps what we need most at a given moment is where we end up bending. If we're needing justice, mm-hmm. we're leaning that way. And if we're, I think of that church in Carolina where the young fellow that had practiced with that little group came in and murdered them, mm-hmm. and the church forgave them.
Mm-hmm.
I think of that as an example of where mercy totally outweighed mm-hmm. justice, mm-hmm. and that it was godly mm-hmm. and close to impossible for the basic human being. Mm-hmm. To be able to do that, I mean, that was remarkable.
Well, but that's an example of where, like the family forgave mm-hmm. the guy, but mm-hmm. the guy should still go to prison.
Right, yes.
Would be an example of... Mm-hmm.
Yes, and what the family is saying...
Justice and mercy.
Justice and mercy. And what the family is saying is, we forgive them, we're leaving the justice, human justice, to the state. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's more of the give unto God the things that are God, give unto Caesar mm-hmm. the things that are Caesar. Wow. We're giving human justice mm-hmm.
okay.
to the state. Mm-hmm. Our business is to follow God, and God calls us to forgive. Mm-hmm. All right? Mm-hmm. There was something really important I was going to say about that you triggered for me, and now I can't remember what it was.
It'll come to you tonight. In the
it will.
Of the
it absolutely will.
Don't,
that's okay.
Don't call me. And I was going to say something that I want to throw you off.
No, that's okay.
I think
Keep
that's where the Catholic, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just Catholic, mm-hmm. where purgatory came from. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. it's hard for us to believe. Like, mm-hmm.
right.
And it's also hard for us to understand how someone could murder, mm-hmm. we believe, mm-hmm. say he's sorry before he dies, and then dies, and he's eligible for heaven.
Right.
That bothers a lot of mm-hmm. people. So
yes.
I wonder if that's where the purgatory mm-hmm. thing came from, where, okay, you're going to suffer some, but, mm-hmm. you know, that you
What about confession, though? Sure. If you have a confession.
Same thing.
I mean,
the priest usually say, you're forgiven, but go say 20 Hail Marys or something like that.
There's always some kind of repentance.
Right. There's something you have to go and do.
Right.
Not in the way the Episcopalians do confession, but in the Catholic concept of confession. Yeah. Human moral development was where I was going. If you've studied, those of you who are teachers have done this. If you look at the moral development of children, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When they're very young, there is no moral development. You know, the mind, right?
Right,
those of you who've had 2-year-olds or been around 2-year-olds, everything I want is mine. I want mine. You know, some of the first words we learn to say, want and mind. Then, as they get a little bit older, there are very strict rules about what's fair.
Black and white.
Right? And black and white, you know, that's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why isn't it fair? You know, well, because he got more than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many of you have,
mm-hmm. yep.
you know, adjudicated those discussions with your children, you know. He got more cookies than I did. His is bigger than mine, you know.
Yeah.
We should all get exactly the same. And so that's the next phase of human moral development, is that there are specific rules of fairness that must be followed by everybody, right? And it goes along with following rules. This is also when kids get into tattling,
oh,
right? You know, you said, you know, and as a teacher, you just want to make a tape that says, why don't you worry about you? And, you know. And then the next phase of human moral development is the ability to see that there may be some reasons why rules have exceptions, and moving into that sense of equity rather than equality, right? That maybe it isn't fair for everybody to be given the same. Maybe what's fair is for somebody to be given more
what they need
as opposed to exactly the same as everybody else. And then the next phase of human moral development is what we're doing now, which is the looking at the basis for moral decision and realizing that there is no one basis.
How many people get to that stage?
Well, that worries me. you know, it's like anything. There are a lot of... Everybody gets out of the... Well... I was about to say everybody gets out of the, well, it has to be exactly the same or it's not fair, but actually there's some people I've heard speak in public recently who haven't. Humans who are developing within the normal range move out of.
Okay. How diplomatic.
It has to be absolutely fair. Okay. But a lot of us get stuck in the teenage piece. Mm-hmm. Which is, the thing about teenagers is they kind of revert back to the two-year-old phase of where everything's all about me, which is developmentally really appropriate when you're a teenager, when you're beginning to figure out who you are. It kind of is a little bit all about you because you're figuring out who you're going to be. Mm-hmm. Most of us move out of that.
Right. For some of us, it takes a whole lot
that,
longer than others.
I have some ex-husbands. You know.
This is actually why education is so important. You know, my husband teaches ethics too, and I'm like, you have one of the most important jobs because this is when people think about it. A lot of people don't get to that point.
But there are people who feel questioning is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the Catholic Church, you don't question.
Right.
That was people in the United States. Mm-hmm. You don't question. He's your president. Yes. You just, whatever he says goes. And that's not
But it took me until my 30s to ask a question and feel like I was entitled to ask the question.
Well, and beyond...
Labeled a communist, I was
had a long period of purgatory.
Well, and beyond that, not only asking a question... But then having the answer to the question allow you to reform what you believe.
Okay, absolutely. That's
a lot of people never get there, that they feel that they have the authority, the agency, to use the term, to reform your belief based on new input.
This is what happened to feminism, actually. That's why feminism developed, because women didn't have the right to question. They took what their male counterparts, their fathers, and then their husbands told them.
So it's
now developed.
And I came late to the party.
So, but, you know, not a lot of people get there. And ultimately it becomes, you can live perfectly well in the world if you've reached the kind of teenage level of development. You can live perfectly well in the world without pushing it further, but our Buddhist friends would say you'll never reach true enlightenment.
That's right.
We would say you'll never truly live the abundant life that God promises you.
You're always striving.
If you don't do the work to struggle with what you individually believe. I mean, I can tell you what the church has taught through time, and you know, and I can tell you what I believe, and you can accept what I believe and never just make it your own. But then you don't get to live the abundant life that God has promised, because part of that abundant life is coming back to the first thing we talked about. Seeing yourself as someone with moral agency and the ability to make a difference, not just for yourself, but for the world around you, and with the right to decide how to do that for yourself. And that, at least from my perspective, is part of the abundant life. When, you know, when Jesus says, I came that they may have life and may have it abundantly, that's part of it, is that we can rely on God's grace. God loves us even though we're not perfect, and even though we're going to make mistakes, God loves us anyway. We can rely on God's mercy and God's forgiveness, and that gives us the freedom to try some things for ourselves, because it's okay if we fail. It's okay if we make a mistake. God still loves us. Eternal life is already ours. We don't have anything to be afraid of. And so we can live abundantly.
Mm-hmm. Extremely hard.
And we have to do it for the right motivation or mm-hmm. reason.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, self, you know, I mean, just to make yourself look good or whatever, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
we talked about before.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I would say, and I'm not God, so, you know, judgment is not mine, but I think God would say that He'll take good things done for the wrong reason with the hope that you will eventually do good things for the right reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually did the envelopes I gave you were Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts did that. You know, I was working with 10-year-olds on their duty to God badge. Uh-huh. And so we started with, you have one of the things, if you're going to do your duty to God, is you have to serve others. Hmm. That's part of it. And so they came here on Monday, and they made Post-it notes for us to put on food bags of kids, and they made little bags of things for the homeless. The reason they were doing it was, I want the badge.
You get a badge.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, God would say, and I would say, that's not the right reason to serve others. But they're 10.
Mm-hmm.
So we teach you, you know, we teach you that part of your duty to God is serving others, and you do it because you get something out of it.
Yeah.
Eventually, as you mature, we hope, you do it because it's the right thing to do, and then you do it because it feels good, and then you do it because
it's the love of God.
It's the love of God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's step 10. But if you never do step 2, you'll never get to step 10.
Uh-huh. Doesn't that fit in with, like, random acts of kindness?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just an anonymous random mm-hmm. acts of
yes.
kindness.
Yes. Okay, we've gone beyond our time.
Way over.
So, yeah, it's 11:15.
Oh,
so, so I will get this converted to podcast, and I'll send you the link. It's,
oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, because I keep listening, and then I don't have it, and I would like to go back.
Can we give you all our emails? Because that one day that was snowy and stuff.
Yes.
We should maybe you could just let us know if you're deciding to, or you are here.
The rule is, and we're moving into winter. Actually, I'm going to stop this because.